Welcome to the podcast series, Intel on AI. Each episode explores human-centric topics related to artificial intelligence through conversations with leaders in the field. I'm your host, Abigail Hing Nguyen. Ed Xu is the Senior Advisor of Disruptive Technologies at the World Bank. In his role, he's in the rare position of sitting at the crossroads of one of the oldest problems, global poverty, and the newest opportunity, artificial intelligence. AI is changing the developed world, but how is it being translated for those living in extreme poverty? Ed, thanks so much for joining me today to share your insights.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure.
Before we dig in, I'd love for our listeners to get to know you a bit. I know you love to trek and you're a great outdoorsman. Can you share about one of your favorite adventures?
Sure. Yeah, I love the outdoors, love getting out there, love trying new things. So one of my favorite adventures was my wife and I, actually, before we were married, we joined a group of about five people and we biked from Hong Kong through China, through Tibet, and then into Nepal. And then we spent a month trekking in Nepal as well. So it was great. We carried everything on our bikes. We had about 60, 70 pounds on our bikes. And it was just amazing. We camped along the way. We camped in Chinese villages, in Chinese cemeteries. We biked uphill in Tibet. We biked downhill off the Tibetan Plateau into Nepal, into Kathmandu. So it was really just an amazing time and also a great way to test our relationship to see if we were ready for marriage.
Wow. Villages, cemeteries, biking throughout Tibet. What an amazing adventure. Your trip sounds like it plays into a lot of the research that both of you have done over the years.
It has. Yeah.
So what led you to the World Bank 20 years ago?
So after college, I went into finance, as you mentioned. I worked at JP Morgan doing M&A. I worked at an Italian bank doing leveraged finance. I actually worked at a startup as well in New York City where we connected art galleries to buyers over the internet. This is the early days of the internet. And coming out of business school and policy school, I was really inspired by the mission of the World Bank. When you walk into the lobby, there's a sign there that says, "Our dream is a world free of poverty." And just having also traveled a lot and just seen how people are living in different places and how a lot of things we take for granted, electricity, running water, healthcare, is not something a lot of people have around the world. So just to the thought of being part of this effort to, you know, help ensure that everybody around the world has access to health, to water, to food, and everybody has an equal chance to succeed is something that I was really drawn to. And so that's why I joined the World Bank. I started in the private sector arm of the World Bank, where we work with companies or startups or efforts that are creating jobs in developing countries. And it's been a really great experience being at the World Bank.
And this is something you and I have talked about over the years, how to have a sustainable approach to these questions. You're looking in particular for for-profit solutions to issues of poverty and other questions in the developing world.
That's right. I think at the World Bank, we think a lot about not just helping people for the short term, but what's going to be the long-term solution. And so, you know, to take a step back, the World Bank was created at the end of World War II. Our first mission was to rebuild Europe. And then after that, our mission became, how can we look at some of the major challenges of the day and how can we help those other countries that haven't developed as well? So I think when we look at what's happening with a lot of different types of poverty reduction efforts, if it doesn't last, if it doesn't create jobs in the long term, if it doesn't also ensure that we do it in a sustainable way where we're not degrading our environment, for example, where we're dealing with climate change, then the solutions aren't going to last.
So let's get a sense of how many people we're talking about. I have some numbers here. Global population is just under 8 billion, with about 6 billion living in developing countries. So we're talking about 75% of the world's population. And as for poverty, I know the World Bank has two definitions. There's extreme poverty, living on less than $1.90 per day, and moderate poverty, which is less than $3.10 a day. So Ed, is that per capita, per family? And can you give us a sense of what that buys people?
Yes. So we focus on extreme poor, those who live on $1.90 a day or less. And I think our latest numbers, there was about 750 million people still living under $1.90 a day, and that's per capita. And so what does that buy you? Well, I mean, you can imagine that's why we call it extreme poverty. You're living on a substance level. You're also at extreme risk of really not having the essentials to live. So it can barely buy you enough to eat and you're living day to day. What we also looked at is, you know, what is going to be the impact of COVID on these numbers as well. Probably we estimate around 736 million. You mentioned 8 billion people. So we still think there's almost 10% of the people who are living in extreme poverty. And at the World Bank Group, we actually set a goal for ourselves that we want to help reduce the number from 10% to 3% by 2030 of those living in extreme poverty. And what we felt there was that once you get it down to 3%, that's basically ending extreme poverty on a sustainable basis, in the sense that there's always going to be some extreme poor because of refugees, wars, or things like that, some structural elements of poverty. But if we can get it down to 3%, that's basically ending it on a sustainable basis going forward. So that's a goal we set for ourselves, to end it by 2030.
You know, it's so hard for us in the United States to really wrap our heads around that kind of extreme poverty. And to be honest, it's a bit discouraging to think that even in another 10 years, we're still going to have extreme poverty in the world. So a harder question, the World Bank has been around for 76 years. Why do we still have this kind of poverty even today? Why haven't we solved the problem yet?
Well, if we look at the numbers, we have seen tremendous progress over the past few decades. In 1990, we estimated that 36%, or nearly 2 billion people, lived in extreme poverty. So given where we are today, where we're about 10% of the world, that's a tremendous achievement. And that's largely led by a reduction in poverty in Asia. So now we're seeing an increasing concentration of extreme poverty where progress has lagged. This is mostly in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia. And the reasons for this are multidimensional and complex. And we also know that in the short term, there are various economic shocks that can severely impact countries, both at the national and global level. And right now we're in the middle of one caused by COVID-19. So solving all of these long-term challenges, as well as dealing with the short-term challenges, is certainly beyond just what the World Bank can do. But we are committed to working with governments and other partners to put together comprehensive approaches that try to address all of these issues. But I'm also glad that the reason we're here talking today is the central role that technology and innovation plays in catalyzing economic growth and reducing poverty. We're committed to helping countries adopt and harness these technologies for economic growth and poverty reduction.
And what do you think are the biggest problems you're going to have to solve to get there?
Well, I think broadly there's two issues. One is, how can we catalyze economic growth within each of these countries that we're working with? And there's a lot of challenges to that, whether it's from the human capital side, giving people the skills, making sure people have the right healthcare in order to take advantage of the opportunities. And then there's also sort of the hard infrastructure side of it. You need roads, you need schools, you need electricity for the jobs to thrive. And then there's also then the inequality aspect of it. So even if you have economic growth, that's what we want to see. We want to see the pie is growing, but how is the pie shared? So then we also want to see growth in a way that benefits the bottom half of the population in terms of their income. So this is what we call shared prosperity. And we see that happening through better social protection programs. We see it happening through better tax programs as well, tax incentives. But we also think that the type of jobs that are created, we have to ensure that people can take advantage of it. So coming back to the human capital side, making sure people have the right skills to take advantage of the opportunities.
In terms of the inequality, where are you seeing this extreme poverty concentrated in the world?
So right now, we see a huge portion in sub-Saharan Africa and still a lot in South Asia. Fortunately, we've seen a lot of impressive gains in East Asia and in Latin America. So extreme poverty has really gone down a lot there. So going forward, we do see the extreme poor will be concentrated primarily in sub-Saharan Africa and some pockets of South Asia, which would include India and Bangladesh. I think one of the issues in sub-Saharan Africa is the issue of fragility, conflict, and violence. So you have a lot of states there which are not stable, ongoing wars that create problems like famines or drought or problems of food and agriculture. So we do think that this is something that's going to have to be tackled as well, alongside economic growth, inequality, tackling root causes of fragility, conflict, and violence.
It's another thing that we just don't really fully grasp here in the developed world. We have enough food to feed the world's population, but all these other issues that you're talking about, the politics, the conflict, those keep us from closing these gaps. Now, you also mentioned COVID. Can you talk more about that? Who do you think are going to be the most impacted by COVID, and what's going to be the impact on global poverty in general?
So COVID is a shock unlike any that we've ever seen. So I think first, on the health side of it, we're very concerned that, you know, a lot of the protection that we've seen happening in advanced economies that developing countries don't have. Already, I was reading, I think today, India has become the third largest country in the world in terms of COVID cases, and it's just going to increase further. So I think there's a massive health cost. We talked a lot in the US about the number of ventilators we have. In some of these countries, there might be two ventilators in the entire country. So the healthcare systems are just not equipped to handle this. Even aside from the health impact, there was an estimate from the IOL that half of the world's workers could lose their jobs, with a huge hit on the informal economy. And the informal economy are those who don't, you know, have a traditional job. They may be in a small, medium enterprise. They may be working on their own. They may be working day to day without any type of sort of employment contract that you or I would have. Those workers are going to be hit very hard. We also see remittance flows down by 1/5 already. We did a study where we saw, I think globally, there's about 500 billion of remittances each year. We projected to be down by over 100 billion this year. So at the end of it, we see an additional around between 70 and 100 million more going into extreme poverty because of COVID. So this is a huge setback for the goal of eliminating extreme poverty. And a lot of those will be in South Asia as well. We've seen also that the reason India has been hit so hard is the density of the population. And it's extremely hard to control. And you also see large refugee populations in Bangladesh, for example, where COVID is going to hit very hard there as well. So we do see that this is going to be not just a health catastrophe, but a huge economic catastrophe. Another population we're very concerned about is women, where we see the risk for women also heightened during COVID. There are 740 million more women who are working in informal employment. And when you think about some of the impacts of schools being closed and other things, this often hits women harder. This is a population which we're also trying to ensure that they don't lose the gains that they've had as well.
Yes, thank you for that. I mean, I think we're definitely seeing the same issues in the developed world. And what we're hearing from you is how they're so much more exacerbated in the developing world. So I'd love to talk a bit more about what you guys are working on to address this, specifically about the role of technology, artificial intelligence, and machine learning. You know, even before COVID, there's been a lot of interest in the space. There's a new field of machine learning for the developing world, ML4D, with classes being offered at universities. There's tracks devoted to it at major conferences like NeurIPS. Last December, for example, there were folks talking about using machine learning to predict pregnancy outcomes in India and to use digital IDs in the constitutional courts in Kenya. And this was at the conference in Vancouver. And it seems like the sentiment overall is that we're not going to need new statistical machine learning methodologies, but what we're looking at are new applications of existing methods in the context of the developing world. So I'd love to hear more about your thoughts here and what the role of AI machine learning has been in helping you achieve your efforts, and maybe some specific use cases where you're seeing success.
So I think that at the World Bank, you know, we often work either with private companies or mostly with governments. So our role is to work with the government and help them to design a, whether it's a health program, agriculture program, infrastructure project, social protection program, as well as provide them the financing to implement these projects. But one of the biggest obstacles we see is actually capacity among these governments, that they don't necessarily have the data science training, they don't have the data scientists on their staff. They don't have the understanding of what AI can and cannot do. There's certainly a lot of interest, but then the ability to carry it through is one of the biggest problems. So that's where we see the role of the World Bank, is that we can go and work with technology companies. We can look at the solutions. We can vet the solutions and help them to understand which are the ones that could apply in their case, which are the ones that will work, which are the ones that won't work, and where should they focus their efforts. And we also try to do a lot around capacity building and doing a lot of training for civil servants. In fact, Abby, you were very helpful when we brought a team from Cambodia, a study tour to Silicon Valley, and we visited Intel, and they just learned a tremendous amount of what AI and ML can and cannot do, and you know where the innovation is. So we're trying to do a lot of activities like that. Now, you mentioned a lot of the interest in AI ML in developing countries. We've seen a lot of pilots. So we've seen a lot of interesting, more on the smaller scale efforts. And so what we're trying to do is, what are some of the efforts that can really scale up? If we look at satellite imagery, I think that's definitely a field in which you have a lot of great and very interesting work going on that is scalable, and where you have a lot of new satellite imagery companies, existing ones. Planet Labs has been a partner of the World Bank for quite some time. We are also invested in them through our private sector arm. But we've seen some very interesting use cases around being able to understand crops and agriculture much better, be able to get ahead and predict how crop yields will turn out. We've looked at being able to get a better handle on the impacts of climate change, looking at forestry, for example, you know, the impact upon forestry. So that's one area where we would love to continue to do more on. One of the challenges there is actually that satellite imagery can be quite expensive as well. So some of the satellite imagery that is provided free of charge from some agencies is good, but it's not always the resolution that we need to get the kind of results that we want. We've looked at other fields such as health. I think there's a lot of interesting work around diagnosis. But the issue we've seen there is that a lot of the algorithms have been trained on data from developed countries. So when you take this and you move it to a developing country context, the population is quite different. So first you have the disease profile might be quite different for a lot of reasons, whether it's because of the population factors or the context in which they're living. You have a very different prevalence of different diseases and how they spread. And second is the treatment could be quite different as well. Many of the treatments that we have in America, for example, are not available in Kenya or other countries. The treatment has to be quite different. You have to think about what could be the treatment in a low resource context, or even in that particular country. What is the public health clinics that are available? What are the pharmacies actually selling on the streets? Within these pharmacies, how do you think about the quality or the efficacy of whatever they're selling? Because you have a much higher rate of sort of counterfeit drugs or drugs that are not effective being sold in these countries. So there are so many factors that require you to take a health solution, for example, and localize it within a developing country. Those are things that we're looking at. And, you know, we're working with our clients to think about how can we put in the resources to localize these solutions and then start to test them and scale them up. But it's not a very easy task, you could say.
This always seems like one of the issues that we struggle with when we take technologies from the developed world and try to contextualize them for the developing world. And I'm wondering, what have been some of the best state-of-the-art learnings from that process, even outside of the machine learning context, that we could apply here?
I mean, I think satellite imagery is actually a good example because the data is pretty much the same wherever you go, right? So you're looking at a picture. So I think wherever you have a situation where the data sets are common across developed countries and developing countries, then you can apply a common methodology to it, right? And you can derive similar insights. So you want to look for cases where you have very similar types of data sets. I think, you know, financial access is another area that we think there's a lot of potential in, particularly around credit scoring, as well as helping banks to manage their portfolios much better. There you have similar types of financial data that banks are seeing and using. And you also have a lot of innovation around fintech companies to take models that have been used in developed countries and taking them to developing countries. And there's one very interesting startup that we were looking at called Tala, which uses information that's already on someone's cell phone and provides kind of a credit scoring based on that type of information.
Is that information based on their emails or their behavior, their buying patterns?
Yeah, it's based on their behavior. It's kind of proprietary, so they haven't told us everything that it looks at, but it does look at, you know, a combination of who are their contacts, what are the kind of things that they're doing, where are they going?
Oh, interesting.
But they try to keep everything proprietary, so they don't even want that data to leave the phone, right? So I think interesting models like that could have applicability across countries.
It's like microfinance, looking at local social networks and communities to provide credit scoring.
That's right. I mean, I think you look at the Alibaba Ant Financial model, right? Where Ant Financial in China used a lot of the information coming from the Alibaba e-commerce site then to provide financing based on that information. Incredibly powerful. So within the fintech space, there's a ton of innovation going on. At the World Bank, we've been working on access to finance for a long time. We've seen, you know, our latest estimate was that about 2 billion people don't use financial services. And this hurts people both when you're an SME and you're trying to access finance in order to grow your business, or even if you're a person who wants to put money into savings. It really hurts if you don't have a place to go, you don't trust your bank. And I think coming back to one of the populations we talked about, I think getting more access to women entrepreneurs is also one of the priorities of the World Bank. And what are the problems with access to finance that they face? Often they face a lot of discrimination at banks who are unwilling to lend to women entrepreneurs. And so we're looking for new types of models that can sort of prove out the creditworthiness of women entrepreneurs or other groups that aren't able to have sufficient access to finance. So I think there's certainly a lot of potential to look at different types of data and their relationship to credit scoring that can then help financial intermediaries and new fintech models to lend more.
So I'd love to talk again about the use cases around satellite imagery, specifically how that's beneficial to your work in studying crops and climate change and forestry.
You know, what are the problems that policymakers face? Satellite imagery can provide, you know, so much interesting data that otherwise would have been really hard to find. So another use case we're looking at is around understanding the growth of cities and urban development. So many times policymakers actually don't even know where people are living as they think about what services to provide. So we had one project where we did a combination of satellite imagery and we also used drones to look at the growth of the urban low-income populations outside of Zanzibar. And this was incredibly helpful to understand, you know, how to design your transport systems, how to think about roads, how to figure out where people are so that you can also provide services to them, whether it's from the standpoint of social protection or education or health. We're also looking at, you know, especially this time, we're exploring a lot of how can we better understand where we can put mobile health clinics. This is not just satellite imagery data, but now looking at mobility data broadly. So we've been partnering with telephone companies or mobile operators to get information from them, particularly their call data records, and other providers who also have data. For example, Google publishes its mobility data reports that look at where people are moving, how much they're moving, where they are, because we're working with a lot of countries to determine where should we put the COVID testing sites, where should we put the COVID response clinics, and where you put this can have a huge public health impact. You know, even in America, we've seen that a lot of the reasons testing is not done is because it's not accessible to certain populations. And this will really have a big impact upon the spread of COVID in a particular place if you don't give that population access to resources that it needs. So we've seen that bringing in new sources of real-time data, whether it's satellite imagery, mobile data, you mentioned sort of social networks is another interesting source of real-time data. But we're exploring a lot of different sources of real-time data from a lot of companies. Even financial data is actually very interesting because you can get a sense of what people are doing based on their transactions. And so we actually have an initiative called the Development Data Partnership, where we're working with private sector companies, including large tech companies like Facebook and Google and smaller ones like Mapbox, where we sign sort of data sharing agreements and they provide this real-time data to us to help us with various types of different projects, whether we're designing a new transport project or an agriculture project or even an education project that helps us better understand how to design that project.
And speaking of transportation, I know when we were talking earlier, you mentioned that transportation is actually surprisingly effective at addressing poverty as well, because so many of the people who need jobs need to go somewhere else to get there and need to travel from where they're living.
Yeah, exactly. So one interesting project we did previously was after the earthquake in Haiti, we were helping the government design a new public transit system. And there we used mobile data to understand where people lived, where people worked, and how can you best design the transit system to get people to where they needed to go. And I think this has a big impact upon poverty because oftentimes where the poor live is quite far from the urban centers where the jobs are. And if they cannot get there, then they just don't have access to those economic opportunities. So we've done some studies to see there's quite a large economic impact when you can connect people physically to more economic opportunities. If you can cut down their commute, I mean, in many of these countries, the poor are commuting 1, 2, 3 hours for a job. And you can imagine the cost to them economically just to be in transit and the cost to their household as well. And if you start to think about the impact upon their family, upon their kids, what is the type of care they're able to provide to their kids, the quality of the transit system and how pro-poor you could say the transit system is, you know, is incredibly important. So I think the more data we have and then using ML AI techniques to analyze this data, to ensure that we can have a transport system that is optimized to give economic opportunities to the poor. This is a really important use of technology for our work.
What are some of the barriers to getting data that you need?
You know, one barrier is that the data is not there, it's not collected as well as it is here in developed countries. But the second barrier is the data governance is also not there as well. So in many of these countries, there's a lack of regulations around data. And so a lot of times the private sector may hold the data, but there aren't clear regulations around, you know, who has access to that data. There isn't a way in which, for example, governments can work with the private sector to get access to that data. So I think we at the World Bank, we're actively looking at this, and we're actually publishing a report later on this year around development data. And we're looking at what is the benefits of data, as well as what are the risks. So certainly we see a lot of risks that the data being collected is not going to benefit the poor. It's not going to benefit those within those country. So we do think that it's really important to have very strong data governance, but in a way that enables really good data collection, enables good data sharing, enables the appropriate use of data on behalf of these goals we've talked about, of ending poverty, of supporting economic growth, of supporting more economic opportunities for the poor. So we're very much, you know, supportive of better efforts to collect data, but also building capacity within the government to put in place a strong data governance system, which is not there many of the times.
Exactly. I completely agree with you. I think this is the problem with data in general. There's so much talk right now about bias and data, you know, for example, where women may not be represented fairly in the data because of historical underrepresentation. And I think that's what we're talking about here. The data from the developing world is going to be underrepresented. Google has this initiative about focusing on the next billion users, including those who aren't even online yet. And I think that's what we're talking about. I think that, you know, that's one of the efforts to correct for things like this, but we still have a long way to go.
No, absolutely, Abby. I think that this is something which, at least at the World Bank, we see ourselves as an advocate for developing countries and for the poor in developing countries. And certainly it's not quite apparent yet, you know, what is the protection that they're going to have? One interesting thing we saw was that the poor are actually very concerned about data privacy. In Nairobi, we did a survey where we looked at how many people would rather have a loan with a higher fee and strong data privacy, or a loan with lower fees, but lower data privacy. And we saw that most of them, they'd rather pay a 10% fee and have strong data privacy than a lower fee, 5%, but then not be sure that their data wouldn't be shared with others. So I think this is something where you can see that even those that don't have a lot of disposable income, that they're willing to pay more for data privacy. And this just underscores the importance of having strong data privacy regulations in developing countries and how important it is for even the poor, for them to be able to understand where their data is going and have the appropriate safeguards in place for them.
Interesting. It's similar to issues that we're wrestling with here in privacy and data. You know, there are voices who have asked how things would change if certain data, like healthcare data, for example, were a public good. Daphne Kohler has made analogies to organ donation programs in parts of Europe that are opt out rather than opt in. And as a result, they saw a significant increase in donations. So the question I remember she raised was, if we did the same thing with certain healthcare data, would we have higher quality outputs? So it sounds like you're running into similar questions in the developing world. Are you seeing any trends emerge here?
I don't think there's any opting. It's I think they don't have that level of decisions, right? So this is where the lack of a data governance, lack of regulations within these countries are really hindering the emergence of, for example, these opt-in, opt-out systems that you have here in advanced economies.
Mm-hmm. So you're operating blind then. You don't know where the regulations will land eventually.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Well, how can we help in the developing world? What are some ways that AI engineers and tech companies can ensure that they have the most impact on the kinds of work that you're doing?
I mean, I think that oftentimes, you know, you have a lot of interesting initiatives, like we were saying, in developing countries, a lot of great startups who understand the local context and are trying to solve the problem, but they may lack access to the engineering talent that you have here in the US or other places. I think it would be great to have more partnerships between the AI engineers, you know, here and developing countries. At the World Bank, we started an effort where we started to put together different problems and then partner with companies like Google and Amazon and Microsoft to solve these problems. One example is last year, we worked with Amazon, Microsoft, and Google to build a model that would help predict when and where the next famine would occur. A lot of it had to do with crops, obviously, weather, but also market prices. This has been very helpful to come up with a system in which we're able to now deploy funds to places quicker than we could before. another problem we're looking at is around energy. And electricity is still a problem in many countries. I think over a billion people don't have access to reliable energy. And this is really the foundation of a lot of economic opportunities and jobs that we were talking about before. So there's a lot of interesting data coming in where you can use AI ML techniques to have better prediction around what is going to be the demand for energy, as well as where will the supply come from. So the more you can optimize that demand and supply, especially with new sources of energy, renewable sources of energy, for example, solar and wind, the more you can have one, a better mix of more renewable energy sources, as well as you can meet demand more reliably. So right now, that's another problem we're looking at. You know, we're very happy to partner with others in the World Bank. We're going to continue to bring out a lot of these interesting problems and put it out to the world and see who wants to partner with us. And we're also going to try to do a lot more on capacity building. I mean, that's one of the first things we talked about, is that many of our clients, many government policymakers don't have the ability or don't have the data scientists on their team, don't have the AI scientists on their team. You know, would love to have more partners to help us train these policymakers. And the other, I think, is within many of these technology companies, the more you can explore what are the issues in developing countries, what are the problems. Many of the problems that are traditionally looked at are just trying to optimize something that's happening in America. But the more you can work within your company and say, hey, let's really look at what's happening. What is the problem in some other countries, in Bangladesh, in Cambodia, you know, in South Africa, in Kenya? What are the solutions we can bring to those countries? I think that the road to profitability may be a bit longer, but I think that, like you were saying, Google has a great initiative called the Next Billion Users Initiative. There are going to be opportunities there. And I think that it will take a little bit of a push within these companies to focus, but I think those companies that can get there, I think are a better position for the long run as well. So those are two areas I would say, come and partner with us, with the World Bank. We have a lot of different problems we're happy to partner with you on. Work with local entrepreneurs, and then within your own company, really push and look at what are the problems you can solve in developing countries.
Yeah, and I know that's something, again, looking back full circle, that's something that's always been important to you to think about. How do we get these tech companies to think about issues of poverty and addressing them, not necessarily on a philanthropic basis, but about the market opportunities that would drive them to address them inherently?
That's right. And that's where we started. You know, we looked at what's a sustainable path to economic growth. We're not here for, you know, one or two short-term solutions or things that look, you know, but we really want to have solutions that can drive economic growth in the long term. We want to have solutions that can impact really large portions of our population. We set a very ambitious goal, which is ending global poverty by 2030. And we're not going to get there unless really we are partnering fully with the private sector, with technology companies. And unless they're incentivized, unless they get in the game, you could say that it's not going to happen.
Ed, this has been really wonderful. I'd love to ask you just two more questions. What are your priorities for yourself this year in your role at the World Bank? And what about personally?
I think that in terms of the World Bank, we're still in the early days of understanding where AI and ML can really help to in our goals of ending global poverty. We've touched upon a lot of issues here today. We've talked about agriculture, health, you know, famine prediction, but I think there's so many more applications. And part of my goal is to really take a, you know, two or three really high impact ones and drive them to completion. So I think we're really looking at, for example, this one around optimizing energy, electricity grids, I think is really an important one, and wanting to take some of those problems to completion. And I think that if we can demonstrate, you know, how to take solutions in developed countries and how to localize them appropriately, this can have a big demonstration impact. And it also, in terms of other governments, also seeing the value of these solutions and implementing them within their own countries. So that's something that we're really pushing for this year, is to push that through. And personal, I'd love to get back out there in the time of COVID. It's been really tough to travel, but we are planning a trip to Alaska. if we can get there, you know, the trails are empty. So it's a great time to be out in Denali National Park, do some glacier hiking. And, you know, I have two small kids, always interested in getting them out and getting them to just experience, you know, the outdoors as well.
Right. Well, I hope you get there, and I hope we all do too. Ed, what is the best way for people to reach out to the World Bank if they're interested in learning more?
You can go to our website, www.worldbank.org to learn more. And I think to, you know, there's a place there you can work with us to contact us. If you have particular interest in AI, feel free to email me at ehsu@worldbank.org. You know, always looking for more partners in AI and ML.
Well, Ed, thank you so much for taking the time to chat today. I'm always so amazed by all the work that you're doing, both in your personal capacity and at the World Bank. And I hope that we find more ways that we can support the work that you're doing there.
No, thank you, Avi, and thanks for your interest. And it's been a real pleasure, and look forward to continue working with you on this.